Joining me now, Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson as we take a look at the week's news in state politics. And Karen and Howard, thanks so much for joining me today.
Sure.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good.
It's a heck of a day.
It is a heck of a day. Some really interesting things going on. Of course, Governor Kasich was involved in last night's GOP Republican debate, or the redundancy there. But how do you think he did last night?
Well, first of all, I want to drop in. Can I just drop in this whole Trump thing?
Oh, yeah, because that's just, you're right. We do have to talk about that. That's too weird.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Twitter has lost its collective mind, which happens, you know, every couple of days anyway, right. But, you know. But Chris Christie coming out in support of Donald Trump, endorsing Donald Trump for president. I think a lot of people associated Christie and Kasich with each other, and Kasich has even said that he likes Chris Christie. He said, among all the governors out there, Chris Christie was my best friend. And so I just wonder how this is going over, because Christie was in that pack of moderates there, that so-called moderates, that included Jeb Bush, who's now gone, and Christie, and you know, Kasich and Rubio, who are still there. So this has got to just really be pretty amazing news.
That's a big blow for
Christie. I mean, Christie was pretty instrumental in helping Kasich in 2010 getting into the governor's office in the first place.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, what the impact of this is. I don't know who Chris Christie's voters are. I have a feeling that many of them were going to go to Trump anyway. But, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, it could be persuaded maybe. But it's not good news for John Kasich or Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz.
Sure. It is a surprise. I mean, I think whenever you start having candidates, even candidates that didn't do particularly well, when they start endorsing other candidates, you start asking questions about what kind of things, you know, are we looking at a potential ticket here between Donald Trump and Chris Christie? You know,
right.
These kinds of things.
Yeah.
Well, and then you sort of have to look at that. Last night was tough for Governor Kasich, too, because it was hard to get a word in edgewise at the debate.
No, I mean, that debate, and I don't know, you know, what your reaction to it was, Karen, but I mean, it was just unbelievable.
That's pretty much my reaction.
It was, you know, and it got to the point of ridiculousness at some times. I thought it got totally away from Wolf Blitzer, who was, you know, the moderator of the thing.
And moderator, and you put that word in quotes, right?
Yes,
moderator?
Yes, absolutely, yes. And I mean, it got to the point where the person who was doing closed captioning had to put on the screen.
I can't keep up. Help!
No, the unintelligible
yelling.
Unintelligible yelling, and over and over again. And it was unintelligible yelling among mainly among Trump and Cruz and Rubio.
Yeah. And you know, Kasich has tried in the past to try to jump in and get a word in edgewise here, and it hasn't gone well for him. And so I think he has deliberately tried to stay out of some of these things. He has tried not to attack any other candidates, including Trump. And, you know, the question is whether that strategy is working. The polls suggest and the results suggest it's not working. But then again, you do wonder, what are people looking for when they're voting on these candidates? What are the issues that people are using to decide which candidates they're supporting? Are the debates really important to some of these voters who've been turning out in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina?
Well, if anybody was trying to base their vote on what they heard last night, I mean, they'd have a difficult time.
Governor Kasich, was trying to talk about policy, but he just can't get it in there.
And here's the problem, and I don't know, maybe I'd be curious if you agree with us or not, Karen. Everything he has said, John Kasich, in these debates and on the stump, has been basically the same message he used in New Hampshire. Everything was geared towards New Hampshire and New Hampshire voters. And they're a different kind of Republican than, say, you know, South Carolina or Nevada or some, you know, or many of the southern states that are coming up next week.
Right. And, you know, I think one thing that's been very interesting in this campaign is we are seeing kind of the veil pulled off on some of these candidates in terms of the messaging. And you could hear it over and over. If you've watched all these debates, mm-hmm. what, 10 of them? Yeah. You have heard the same messages over and over. And, you know, Christie called out Rubio for basically, you know, playing pre-recorded tracks almost of his message. Last night, Rubio called out Trump for saying the same things over and over. And so, you know, Kasich has certainly said the same things over and over. And a message that you were right, Howard, was tailor-made for New Hampshire, but may not play all that well. It didn't play that well in South Carolina. It certainly didn't play well in Iowa, where he really didn't do a whole lot of campaigning. And now we have these 13 states coming up on Super Tuesday. Is it going to play well in those states? I don't know.
Idea? Well, you know, I look at the states that are coming up, many southern states, some northern states, some East Coast states. I just get the impression that Republican primary voters in general this year are not looking for are not listening to a candidate who says, okay, let's be reasonable, let's be grown up, let's talk to each other, let's work
let's
out
talk policy.
Let's find solutions, blah, blah, blah. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for people yelling.
Yeah.
And being angry.
Yeah, I think that and the establishment, quote, lane that Kasich has occupied, I think that that's not something that the voters are responding to either. This whole idea of I spent 18 years in Congress, I worked on the federal budget back in the 90s, these sorts of things. I don't think people who are interested in voting at this point that have been voting in some of these states are responding to that message. They seem to be responding to the outsiders.
A lot of the Republican primary voters, just the regular rank and file folks, are upset with the Republican establishment. They're not happy with them at all.
So, you know, Karen, you wrote about this. I believe that one big fan that Governor Kasich has is Ohio Senate President Keith Faber.
Sure.
Apparently is cheering him on. He seems to think that Kasich's capable of doing this. Why does he think that?
I think, you know, you have this whole group of Team Kasich leaders here. Senate President Faber is one, House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, who had worked in the Bush White House. He came out in support of Kasich, and these are the folks who have been really pumping up Kasich. They went to New Hampshire and did the door-to-door stuff and everything. And so it's not a huge surprise to see some of these high-ranking state officials coming out for Kasich, though there is one notable exception, and that is Josh Mandel, who's the state treasurer. He has been a Rubio supporter and has been for quite a long time. So, you know, what's going to be very interesting is to see what happens on March 15th. And the reason why March 15th is so important, not just because Ohio, that's our primary, but also Florida, and those two states have winner-take-all delegates. Ohio has 66, Florida has 99, and whoever gets those delegates, and it's not proportional, it's you get the whole batch if you win, and that's going to be really, really huge.
Yeah, everything from March 15th on is winner take all. And, you know, the Kasich people are looking at this thing and saying, hey, look, we got a lot better chance of winning Ohio than Marco Rubio does of winning Florida. And they base that on polling which shows that Rubio is trailing Trump in Florida by double digits. Well, Kasich appears to be trailing Trump in Ohio, too. If you look at the Quinnipiac poll that came out earlier this week, that had a 5 percentage point lead over Kasich for Donald Trump. Now, what, the margin of error was 2.5% plus or minus. So, you know, it's not a done deal. I mean, clearly, John Kasich would be capable of winning Ohio's primary, but it's not a done deal.
No, absolutely not. And I think Super Tuesday is going to tell us a lot about the future. I mean, we have these huge races, 13 of them coming up on Super Tuesday, which is March 1st.
Yeah.
And then you've got four more coming up on March 8th, including Michigan, which Kasich has dedicated a lot of time to. Yeah. And then, of course, the ones that are coming up on March 15th, which is including Ohio. It's going to be a very busy couple of weeks.
And John Kasich is going to try to keep kind of cherry-picking delegates out of these congressional districts, you know, before all the primaries go winner-take-all, and then, you know, try to hit Donald Trump with a big whammy on March 15th by winning Ohio, getting all 66 delegates.
You think he's hanging in there till Ohio, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
While Rubio,
I think that's true.
While he hopes Rubio will lose in Florida. Now, if they both lose their home states, I think that's pretty much game over.
I agree with you. And it'll be interesting to see how Ted Cruz does in Texas.
Yes.
155 delegates, but that's proportional, so he won't necessarily get all of them.
Right.
But if he loses his home state, once again, that's a big deal. There have been a lot of rumors and backroom deal kind of talk that maybe Kasich and Rubio would team up. It'll be very interesting to see if they actually would, even maybe before Florida and Ohio vote.
Yeah.
We'll continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, along with Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. There's some other interesting polling that came out, too, Howard, about Supreme Court nomination.
Well, in the same Quinnipiac poll that looked at Kasich matched up against Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders and looked at all the Republican candidates, I mean, it showed that Kasich would beat either of them by, you know, double digits. The other candidates, it would be closer. But there was one question, and Karen, I don't know if you noticed this or not, you know, about the Supreme Court. And the Supreme, and then the Republicans saying that they're just not going to consider any nominee that comes up to the Senate. And Quinnipiac asked Ohio voters about that. You know, do you think a candidate nominated by the president should be considered, or should the Senate delay action? 56% said consider that nominee. 41% said delay it. Now, and we've got a United States Senator in Rob Portman who is running for re-election who is very adamant about saying, no, we're going to delay this. We're not going to do, you know, he's taking the party line on this.
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting. I mean, it really does push the whole Supreme Court issue to the forefront, which it hasn't been.
Right.
I mean, it's been, you know, the Supreme Court has always been one of those things that's always been simmering in the background there. But this one definitely puts it toward the front. And I spoke to Ted Strickland this week for our TV show, The State of Ohio, for next week.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be talking to P.G. Sittenfeld next week as well. And, you know, he was definitely hitting Rob Portman very hard on that issue. The question is still, you know, is that the kind of thing that people are going to vote on? And you know, when will Obama actually put someone forward? That'll certainly make a difference here in terms of, you know, the Nevada governor that he had talked about. He has already said that he's not interested. So
yeah. Well, and I think whether or not it becomes an issue in this campaign does depend a lot on whom the president, you know, actually nominates.
Right, exactly.
I mean, say you had an African American woman, you know, whose name went up. If the Republicans stonewall that, then you've motivated two bases of support in the Democratic Party, African Americans and women, who would be very angry about a nominee like that being ignored by the Republicans. And by Rob Portman.
Well, just bringing up Sandoval's name put him in a hard spot, too, because you know, it's somebody where how can you oppose somebody who is a fellow GOP member and a very reasonable guy at that, to boot. So.
Right.
And I think, though, this whole idea of, you know, who would Obama choose? Should he go ahead and try for a real progressive liberal candidate and, you know, that has no chance? Or does he try for a more moderate candidate who might have a chance but still probably has no chance given the what the Senate has said? You know, at the very least, if a Democrat wins, Democrats could say, well, the most conservative justice on the court is gone and we're likely to have somebody who would be less conservative than Scalia.
And the poll question, Howard, was not about should he nominate a progressive, should he nominate a centrist.
No.
It was just should his nomination be considered.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of times over history, presidents have nominated Supreme Court justices, and they've been confirmed that they thought were going to be conservative or liberal, and they turn out to be the opposite. in the long run. So you really don't know.
Karen, the state report card on schools came out yesterday, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. What did that end up showing?
Well, this is an interesting situation because it's basically the report card that comes out in the summer. It's been delayed by 6 months because of those whole PARC tests, which a lot of parents were angry about and a lot of teachers were angry about.
Now, what's a PARC test? What is that?
Well, we don't need to worry about that.
Can you describe it in less than 30 seconds?
Yeah. No, it's a standardized statewide test. Let's just put it that way. It was very challenging. A lot of kids apparently didn't do so well because the grades did drop. There were 37 districts last time around that had gotten an A in statewide performance or testing performance on statewide tests, and this time there were only 6 out of 609 school districts that got an A. The average grade was a C, and so there are a lot of districts, a lot of parents, a lot of kids who are, you know, wondering what's going on here, and these grades, they were supposed to make it easy for parents to really evaluate their school district, and now with this delayed release of data and all this confusion, it's very hard for parents to get a sense of how their district really is doing and how their school is doing.
Well, are there going to be any consequences attached to these grades?
Not this time. They're held harmless, so to speak, while the state comes up with a new standardized test that will then eventually go into place. And then, so for a couple of years now, we won't be able to look at these results, and there would be consequences assigned to them, so to speak.
Yeah. Nonetheless, school districts like Cincinnati Public Schools are not very happy about, you know, the grade that they were given.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Based on, you know, a test that they didn't think was fair.
Did they give any consideration to delaying this, Karen?
Well, they did delay it for 6 months.
They were supposed to release.
Right. And they released it in two parts and really seemed to kind of be downplaying the results because they said they were not going to be good. They were expecting these results to go down, these grades to go down because of the challenging PARC tests and because of the real full implementation of Common Core. And so there's a lot of upheaval going on in terms of this data and how people are reading it. And so for right now, nobody is going to face any consequences for grades dropping. But eventually, there's going to have to be some sort of, you know, standard, so to speak.
Now, we also had the State of Black Ohioan speech that was given this week. It was given by Representative Alicia Reese from Cincinnati. What was her message in that?
Well, she basically did the speech to kind of come up against Governor Kasich's State of the State speech, which will be happening in Marietta on April 6th. And so she talked a little bit more about some of the things that she says are concerning to people in the African-American community. And she talked specifically about unemployment and jobs, given that the African-American unemployment rate is still about 10%. And also concerns about the justice system. She wants to see changes in the grand jury system, also body cameras for police, and a ban on imitation guns. And that's the specifically John Crawford bill that she's talked about. And, you know, these are issues that she says have gotten some traction with the administration, with the Kasich administration, with the Police Community Relations Task Force, and also with the Supreme Court, with this grand jury overhaul task force. But she said where no action is happening is in the legislature, and she wants her colleagues in the legislature to start looking at some bills that specifically address these issues.
Did she talk at all about voters' rights?
A little bit. That bill is still there's a Ohio voter bill of rights that's still in the process of petition signature gathering.
Right.
That I don't know if they're aiming for. I think it's unclear whether they're aiming for the 2016 ballot or not. But that's still out there. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned Governor Kasich's speech in Marietta, April 6th.
Yes.
This is going to be the 6th State of the State speech he's delivered, isn't it?
Yes, this is his 6th and his 5th one on the road. And this comes to far southern Ohio. He's been basically to almost every region of the state now.
The first city of Ohio.
Okay.
Yes.
Or the first city in the Northwest Territory.
And southeast Ohio, because I haven't been there yet, right? That's what he's saying.
It seems that way. I mean, typically he's had a reason to go to every place that he's gone. I don't know that there's a particular one, but, you know, he hadn't been to southern Ohio yet, really.
Now, any idea yet as to what issues he might bring up in that speech, Karen?
Not a clue. In fact, the last couple of speeches that he's done have been more overview than policy forward. They really haven't introduced a whole lot of things. They've just kind of recapped what he's been doing. And, you know, in budget years, he talked about his budget and that sort of thing. So I expect more of a recap, more of an uplifting kind of a speech rather than a speech where he's going to announce a whole bunch of things he wants to do.
Now, go ahead, Howard.
Well, and by that time, I think, you know, he'll know whether or not he's going to be on.
Right. Yes.
The presidential nominee, too.
Yeah, I was wondering how the whole running for president thing might reflect in the State of the State speech.
Well, yeah. It's difficult because, you know, obviously he's been gone for a goodly part of the last year.
Yeah. And, you know, there were some questions we kept getting asked over and over. When's he going to do the speech? When's he going to do it? Because this is the latest date that he's ever done, mm-hmm. the State of the State. And, you know, we actually looked it up that he is required to be in the state of Ohio and give an annual address to a joint session of the House and Senate. So we knew this was coming. We just didn't know exactly when.
Hey, Karen, it's not political, but or maybe it is. I don't know. Baseball is coming back.
Everything's political. Okay, that's not political. No. Let's talk baseball.
Let's talk baseball. You're an Indians fan?
I am, absolutely.
Well, you have
My dad's
to be.
A Reds fan, though. Yeah. So I watch the Reds.
Bless him. Well, you know, Tuesday down in Goodyear at Goodyear Ballpark, Reds and the Indians, first exhibition game of the season.
I'd love to be there. I would too.
I wish you could.
But yeah, this is the best time of year because it's everything good is ahead of us. This is the time of year where you can dream about your team actually winning the World Series and then have those dreams crushed later. But you know, it's really nice.
we're all tied for first.
Ohio baseball.
That's right.
And last.
Right.
And Howard, you got to be thrilled. I mean, the Reds got their spring training underway last week.
I actually things look good. I mean, this is going to be a transition year. I mean, you've got, you know, obviously a lot of the more established players are gone, but they have such a great pool of young talent that's going to come up and be the stars of the future. I mean, I'm anxious to see him play.
Is a transition year another way of saying a rebuilding year? Because that's what we're talking about in Cleveland.
Yeah. It is. Well, it is a rebuilding
We've been rebuilding
year.
Since the, what, 30s or 40s?
We are all Ohio baseball fans. Karen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. It's great to talk to you.
Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. And coming up, a look at Kentucky's state political stories of the week. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us this afternoon, Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, Ryland Barton, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ryland, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Howdy, good to be here.
Ryland, one of the stories that you covered this week has to do with an issue involving life insurance companies. Apparently, they were suing the state for requiring them to check up on their policyholders to see if they had died. How did this whole suit get started in the first place?
Well, a couple weeks ago, the Governor Bevin's new insurance commissioner had dropped the defense of that suit. So starting off, those insurance companies had sued the state for requiring them to go back and check the death records to see if their policy holders had died to then notify their beneficiaries. And their issue with it was that they had to do it retroactively. So any of the policies that they already had, they had to go back and start checking death records. So
it wasn't just going forward. It was everything that had already occurred. So they viewed that as being a lot of work and expense. Yeah.
Exactly. So they sued the state. It ended up getting overturned. The Court of Appeals ruled against the insurance companies, and then it got appealed to the Kentucky Supreme Court. And the Beshear administration, the previous governor had been ready to defend that. All the motions had been filed for that case, and then the lawsuit was about to be heard in the Supreme Court on Friday a couple weeks ago, and on Monday the new insurance commissioner dropped the case. And so some legislators recently passed this bill. They actually just passed the bill today in the House that would make it retroactive. And we've just kind of yet to see how that'll do in the Senate, which is led by Republicans. And then, of course, it would have to be approved by Governor Bevin in the end.
Yeah. Do you think they can fix this, though? I mean, to his satisfaction?
Well, I think that the whole issue has to do with that retroactivity, yeah. is my understanding. So if they add the retroactive clause to it, because there's a requirement in Kentucky that any law, if you want to make it retroactive, you got to say that it's retroactive in the bill.
Okay.
Where does this head from here, Ryland?
Well, it's passed the state house, and today it passed 85-0. Now it goes over to the Senate, and it's unclear how it's going to be received over there. I haven't really heard any rumblings yet.
Interesting. But meantime, the suit's been dropped. What was the initial reaction when the Bevin administration said it was going to drop that suit?
The initial reaction was, I mean, there was a lot of outcry, especially from Democrats. The Democratic Attorney General, Andy Beshear, who, of course, is former Governor Steve Beshear's son, has filed a motion to intervene in the case so he can go and defend the state's stake in that case. But that motion's still pending. And my understanding is that case is effectively closed. But I think there's still a chance that he could still intervene in that case.
Now, meantime, Governor Bevin is working on a proposed budget, and what's up with that? How's that shaping up?
We're kind of in the midst of budget wrangling right now. There's all these committee hearings these days of the various cabinets in Kentucky. The secretaries come forth, and they're supposed to kind of describe how these proposed budget cuts are going to end up rolling out in their cabinets. Governor Bevin has proposed 9% spending cuts pretty much across the board for the coming two-year budget cycle, and actually a 4.5% cut for the current fiscal year, which ends on June 30th. And so a lot of the secretaries, there have been a lot of complaints that they're not really providing details of how these cuts are going to roll out. Governor Bevin has said, he's going to leave it up to the secretaries to decide how the cuts will be implemented in their cabinets. And Governor Bevin's budget director as well has just said, we'll ask the secretaries how the cuts will roll out. And pretty much most of the secretaries are coming forward and they don't have a lot of details of exactly what programs are going to be cut or scaled back. This really boiled over this week. The new Health and Family Services Secretary, Vicki Yates Brown Glisson, she's made several presentations of how the budget's going to roll out in her cabinet. But every one of these presentations, she just kind of ends up saying that she doesn't have any details of how that's going to end up rolling out. And some lawmakers got really frustrated this week, accused her of being untruthful, also accused Governor Bevin of buying the election. It got pretty nasty. So we're still kind of waiting to see exactly how those cuts roll out.
Now, well, why is he calling for these cuts, Ryland? What particular reasons
does
he have?
Well, we've got a big, like many states and local governments in the United States, Kentucky has a big pension problem. One of the pension system for state employees is about 17% funded, meaning it has 17% of the money that it needs to make future payouts to retirees.
Yeah.
And some people say that amounts to the worst funded pension system in the country. Also, our teacher retirement system is our biggest drain on the budget right now in terms of its unfunded status. The state keeps on having to put more and more money into these systems because they're so underfunded, and they're selling off assets in those systems. So Governor Bevin says that these cuts are necessary to so that the state can start, saving up and putting money towards the pension systems, and also saving up. He wants to also create a new account, kind of more or less a sweeping fund where extra funds will go into this account and then from there go into the pension system in the future if there's ever any additional funds that need to go towards it. Pensions are the big drain on the budget right now.
As I recall, this was a pretty big campaign issue in the governor's race.
Yeah, it's certainly one that came up a lot.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of observers will find that it's really hard to get people jazzed up about the pension system.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of those eyes glaze over type issues.
Yeah.
But it
Unless you happen to be on that pension system, yes.
That's true, Howard.
Right.
Exactly.
Absolutely true.
But sooner or later, these cabinet secretaries are just going to have to fish or cut bait. I mean, they have to come up with some specific proposals fairly soon. Well,
certainly, eventually they're going to have to, you know, eventually a line item budget will be created. There's no such thing right now, and so a lot of people are just a little, they're left amiss. They're not able to decide. How dire a cut might roll out in a certain cabinet. And so I think that what will end up happening is once the budget wrangling starts rolling out in earnest, which will probably happen in March, the House will end up passing its first version of the budget, which, you know, will end up having line item. This is how much each little program is going to get funded. And then, of course, so the House proposes it, then it gets headed over, then the Senate weighs in, they give their own idea of it, and then they end up kind of hammering out the final details in conference. So I think that, you know, right now it's just kind of waiting on the House to end up creating that first proposal, legislative proposal for the budget.
Now, you wrote about the Kentucky Environment Cabinet and how it was kind of in the same position. It had not come up with any ideas, or at least it's not saying what areas it would cut. What kind of impact is this going to have on the Environment Cabinet, which has a very important role?
Yeah, it's one of these questions. Kentucky has a combined energy and environment cabinet, so this both accounts for kind of environmental regulations, but also, you know, energy issues as well. So there's a lot of worries amongst energy or environment advocates that the budget will end up kind of cutting back on some of these regulatory parts of the environment. Of the environmental cabinet, there's a lot of, possibly cynical worries that those would end up getting cut because the new secretary is an ex coal executive for Arch Coal, and again, it just kind of raises questions with a lot of people that, all right, there's no specifics on exactly how much the mine safety program is going to get cut, and so how do we know whether or not to fight for this issue or not? The one thing that the secretary did elaborate on a bit is that there's a lot of turnover in the cabinet, so there's a lot of vacancies, and he's just kind of saying that, well, we'll kind of see going forward whether or not we need to fill these vacancies. If we're able to kind of continue on with our lives and everything's fine and we have these certain positions vacant, then maybe we'll just leave them vacant or eliminate those positions altogether.
We are talking with Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, Rylan Barton, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. And Rylan, somebody I've heard isn't real happy with the whole budget process right now is the Chief Justice of Kentucky Supreme Court.
Yeah, Chief Justice Minton was one of the few of these officials who really came out with a full-throated criticism of how the cuts are going to roll out in his cabinet, or not his cabinet, but within the judicial branch. He says that, the governor's proposal is to have a 4.5 decrease in spending for this fiscal year, so by June 30th. He says that he's not going to be able to make payroll this year if cuts go down like that. So he says that the courts will have to close statewide. The courts will have to close down for 3 weeks.
Wow.
If these cuts roll out.
Yeah.
He's suggesting that this is going to amount to an unprecedented situation. And the words that he used were possibly a constitutional crisis. Because, you know, there are requirements that the court system, provide speedy trial, meet with, people who have been charged with crimes, provide them with bail. Or bail hearings so that people can meet bail. And, you know, if it's shut down for 3 weeks, you're just going to have people sitting around possibly in jail for 3 weeks.
Right. Do you get a sense, Ryland, if he's bluffing or if he really means this?
That's definitely a question. It's Governor Bevin says he's bluffing. He says that it's not necessary, it wouldn't be necessary to shut down the courts, and to suggest that to do so is blowing it out of proportion. But you know, this is just how the budgeting process works. Sometimes I think you try to characterize how bad it could possibly be, and just kind of see if it sticks. I mean, that might be a little bit of a belittling description of it, but I mean, it's really yet to be seen how how serious that is, and really the only way to know is if how exactly it rolls out. I should also say that another thing that he mentioned was going forward again into the next 2 years. There's going to be a 9%. There's proposed to be a 9% reduction in spending, and Chief Justice Minton says that would effectively, force them to shut down drug courts, which that's something that a lot of people say is super useful. It keeps drug offenders out of the prison system and puts them into rehab. So who knows?
This whole budget process. How difficult is it going to be, given the fact you got a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, to work these things out?
It's going to be difficult. There are some people who are wondering if a budget will even be finished by the end of the legislative session, whether or not the governor would have to call a special session to create a budget. It's going to be pretty difficult. Now there is another little curveball in this process, in that just to provide the lay of the land, there's a Republican-led Senate, they have a wide majority, and then there's a Democratic-led House, which only has a four-person majority for Democrats right now. Now there is there are special elections to fill four House seats in the state house, and that will take place on Tuesday, March 8th, and those four House elections could effectively, if Republicans were to win all of those elections, it would be a 50-50 tie in the state house,
mm-hmm.
which would throw things into unprecedented political territory. The chief thing of this session right now is passing a budget, and if there were a 50-50 tie in the state house, that throws questions into who effectively has leadership, whether the Speaker of the House, the Democratic Speaker of the House, Greg Stumbo, is still the Speaker. I mean, it's a confusing situation.
Well, Kentucky obviously does not have a presidential candidate anymore, and Rand Paul's out, but you're going to have a Republican caucus coming up on March 5th. Is that generating any kind of excitement or...
I think it's certainly generating excitement among Republicans. At least the ones you talk to who are kind of running the thing, they say things are going well and everything's all ready to go. I was talking to the Warren County Republican Party president this morning, and he was saying that everything's going well. And he says that so far the people who have really dipped their toes into the water most visibly so far have been Senator Rubio and Governor Kasich, and we're kind of waiting to see exactly what the climate's like after Super Tuesday. That's really the thing. And there will also be at least two other primaries and caucuses on that day, on Saturday, March 5th. I know that Louisiana has a primary, and I believe Maine has a caucus. So, the attention will be a little bit divided there, but,
Explain to the folks who may not know why you're doing this on March 5th, a Republican presidential caucus. It's a fascinating story. Yeah.
Kentucky's U.S. Senator Rand Paul, of course, running for president this year until he dropped out a few weeks ago, and Kentucky has a law that forbids politicians from appearing on the same ballot twice.
Right.
So Kentucky normally has a presidential primary in May. And if he were to be running for president at that time. He would be on the primary, and he would be on that primary ballot. And if he were to be running for Senate, he would be on that primary ballot as well. So by switching the caucus to by switching the Republican primary to a Republican caucus, he appears on the caucus, and then the Senate primary, you know, being in May. So he was effectively able to switch it out. So Paul convinced the Republican Party to switch to the caucus.
Yes.
He paid them, I know he made kind of a down payment of $250,000 for them to make that switch, because there's a lot of logistics that go into making that switch.
Because they were talking about like $500,000 or something.
I think that he was supposed to end up paying another $250,000. Yeah. I'm not sure if that ever happened, actually. And you know, he held out into that in that presidential race for a real long time, but he had a disappointing performance in the Iowa caucus, and he dropped out soon after that. And so actually, the caucus being this coming Saturday, everybody who filed to be on the Republican caucus will still be on the ballot, even if they've dropped out of the presidential race. So Senator mm-hmm. Paul will still be on the ballot for the presidential caucus in Kentucky, as will Jeb Bush.
And there will be caucus sites in every county.
Not every county, actually.
Okay.
This is part of the interesting logistics of the caucus in Kentucky. Since it's never happened before, and since Kentucky's kind of a historically Democratic state, there's some counties that just don't have a very big Republican presence. So a couple of the counties teamed up, and there's kind of a centralized caucus location for them. But the great majority of them do have caucus locations.
Yeah. Certainly up here in northern Kentucky, I would think they would all.
Yeah, that's one thing I was wondering today. I was asking the Warren County chairman, you know, so where do you think is going to be the most active area for the caucus? And he was saying that, you know, possibly northern Kentucky, since it's both got kind of the – it's a population hub as well as kind of a conservative hub within Kentucky. And of course, Lexington and Louisville, you know, even though that they're often thought to be kind of liberal or Democratic bastions, they, you know, they've got population, so they'll probably be kind of hot spots for the caucus as well.
And you say the evidence of any ground organization is basically maybe Kasich or Rubio?
Yeah, and it's almost not even ground organization. You hear it's kind of they're seeking endorsements, and you'll kind of hear of some state lawmakers deciding that they're going to be rooting for one or the other. Haven't seen a lot of actual on the ground activity in Kentucky yet among the presidential candidates.
Yeah, Ryland and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, Ryland Barton, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson.